It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. I'm getting prepared to plant my broccoli. It's about that time, wherever you are in Alabama. I hope you've got some nice-sized plants. I hope you're getting ready to plant generally, because we're coming into the big planting season for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Mississippi, special place in my heart as I was born there, right? Northwest Florida, special place in my heart because that's where a lot of my family's from, way back. Had a little farm outside Tallahassee before the Civil War. So all these places really should be thinking together about where they are and about how to plant and when to plant. And our seasons are different. Our seasons are very different. They're not quite the same in North Alabama as they are in South Alabama. Not quite the same in North Mississippi as they are in South Mississippi, but there's a lot of overlap. And this is the time. And so I'm thinking about planting all these plants. I've got some Brussels sprouts out. Brussels sprouts are hard the farther south you go, but it's worth trying on occasion. And they seem to take longer to establish and get going. They're also a little hardier. I've got some cabbages out already. Yes, I've got some cabbages out already. I'm getting fennel out. I love fennel. It's great. There's no reason, I think, not to go ahead and get fennel out wherever you are. It's a great little crop. Wonderful crop. Not going to get too much predation from bugs. That is, it ain't going to get eaten by the bugs. And so it's a good thing to go ahead and get out. But there's all these other things. There's kale, and there's collards, and there's mustards, and there's broccoli. So I'm thinking about broccoli this morning, and I'm thinking about what kind of soils, and I realized, oh, the dadgum fire ants. I'll just tell you, I'll just have to digress to say that the dadgum fire ants had built some beds in some places where I wanted to put the broccoli. And I didn't come back, and I had already prepped those beds. They were ready to go. I did it way back in June, and I thought, maybe even May, and I thought, yeah, you know, they'll be ready to go. And, well, the ants thought that was just fine. And they moved in, and I hadn't bothered with those beds, and I hadn't looked at them, and the ants loved it because I wasn't bothering those beds. And so I had a harder time getting the broccoli into those beds. But then I found another place where I had some pretty good organic matter. And I'm hurriedly prepared those beds yesterday for planting the broccoli. And I added some organic matter and some other things. The soil's a little coarse. It's a little rough. And I've got to thinking about soils and how we don't talk about them enough. And I was wondering how organic matter is incorporated. And I tell you sometimes that you really need to add organic matter. And I try to explain why. And it occurred to me something very, very weird from our perspective, because of the way we look at things, there's something very weird about what organic matter does. Organic matter is stuff like leaves. It's stuff like broken down grass clippings. It's stuff like pine bark. It could be if you go to the trouble of making compost, which is, I don't know how you make it. You shouldn't go to too much trouble, because basically everything's going to break down here. Organic matter does that. All that stuff you throw in compost, it's all good. So let's talk about it for a minute. what is this stuff doing in your soil? And here's the thing that just doesn't, that won't seem obvious, that just seems counterintuitive. Soil gets very compacted, and I see this all the time around houses. It gets so compacted that plants can't even move around in it. They can't even get their roots in it. It gets so compacted that water can't move through it. It may just sit on the surface and just, it's just like being the surface is flooded after a rain, so flooded that the plants can barely survive because the water has nowhere to go except sit on the surface. And then as soon as we have several drying days, there's no water left. And so plants are going from one extreme to another. And it depends on how long they can hold their breath and then how long they can go without water. It's like, because, you know, plants got to breathe too, just like people do. Roots got to breathe, just like people. And you get all that water in the top part of the soil, and it's a big problem. And that's a big problem with most of our yards and most of the plants. And so what do we do about this? Because soil gets compacted, and it gets compacted very, very easily. You say, oh, I got sandy soil. My soil doesn't compact. You know what? Have you ever looked at how they build a house? You know what they do before they pour the concrete? What do? They put sand down, and they compact it. Why don't they put clay down and compact it? Because sand can be compacted too. And it, particularly if you got a little bit of silt in it, you're going to get a really great, dense, hard pan in that just, and a hard pan is a great word. I mean, it just, it is what it sounds like. It's a flat layer, a pan, just like your frying pan, a flat layer that is hard. And you can't even get your shovel through it. You can't get, it is just, seems like, gosh, I got dense clay under this. And it's just sand and silt that's compacted. And why does it compact? Because we do all sorts of crazy things, like running our trucks and our cars over our garden beds. And we, and where we're going to grow grass. And we do crazy things like, well, we think, oh, I'm going to garden where, just right here where they built a house. Well, they had all those trucks up there next to the house, and they also had compacting machines that were compacting. I mean, they compacted every bit of soil they could because they think the people building the houses, they think this is what you want. This is how life should be. Because, you know, we got a hammer, and the rest of the world conforms to our hammer. So there it is. You've got compacted soil, I can guarantee it. You know, the other thing that I discovered in thinking about all this, I hadn't really thought about it before quite like this, is that when your soil is super saturated and super wet, when it's sloppy wet, when it actually is so wet that it moves around, you actually don't compact the soil as much as when it's just moderately wet. And in Alabama, soils are moderately wet most of the year. It's just, that's just the way it is. It's, we get a lot of rain, folks. We're the center of rainfall in North America, just generally speaking. I mean, it's huge. 70 inches of rain in Mobile virtually. Some places in North Alabama get close to 70 inches of rain, and there's not much difference in between. We're getting tons and tons of rain. And so it's moderately wet all the time, and so your soil gets compacted very easily, and that means those little particles get so close together and so dense that you can't, you can barely dig in them. So here's the thing. What is that compaction all about? And you think, you know, what I really want to do is get a tiller out and break all that into as many small pieces as I possibly can. In as small pieces as I possibly can, and break all that up. And what happens? It gets more compacted. Yes, you actually use a tiller and it gets more compacted. Why is that? Well, this is the thing that's hard to understand about soils, and we're going to try to talk about it. And here, it's really important. If you want to reduce compaction in your soil, you actually have to get your soil particles to join together into denser pockets. Isn't that weird? Let's talk about it. We'll come back.
In 1814, we took a little trip along with Colonel Jackson down the mighty Mississippi. We fired our guns and the British kept a-coming. There wasn't as many as there was a while ago. We fired once more and they began to run it on down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
On down the Mississippi to the Gulf of Mexico.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
Yes, so how do you make your soil less dense? How do you make it easier for plants to put their roots in the soil and grow and prosper? And here's the thing that it's going to tease your mind. Because you got to think at the right scale. You got to think like you're the size of a soil particle. But what you really want to do, if you want to make your soil less dense, is you want to cement, listen to me carefully, you want to cement your soil particles together. And that's a natural process, the cementing of soil particles. If you think about soil, stay with me just a minute, because this is so important to your yard. Most of the questions I get really are about things that have gone wrong in the soil, and most of those things are in one way or another related to the fact that the ground just can't handle water. The water can't move anywhere, the water can't perk into the ground, it sits on the surface, it evaporates quickly because it sits on the surface, meanwhile it's drowning the plants before it evaporates. You get all these big issues. And it's all about your soil. And it's all about the soil being compacted. And listen, I'm going back and I'm telling you, listen carefully, that the problem is your soil particles are just flying around without being held together by anything. Now, isn't that weird? Now, listen. Imagine what you want your soil particles to be. It's like a big chunk of granola. Everything cemented together in a little particle in a bag with lots of other particles that are also big. Does that help? If you take a tiller and you say, okay, I'm going to break this soil up. Well, you are going to break it up. What you're going to do is you're going to break up all those little particles that are cemented together in various ways, granola-sized particles, and you're going to grind them up into a little powder. And what's going to happen? That powder is going to compress, and no water is going to perk through it, and it's going to be more dense after you till it than it was before. Wow. And it's probably even worse with things like sandy soils, sandy loams, that are typical in South Alabama. It is worse. Because those sandier soils really have relatively weak bonds between the particles. What causes those bonds between the particles? Oh, gosh. Just hold with me just a minute, because this is really important. And there's been some recent research that says, what causes these granola-sized particles? These chunks of particles. Nah, you're not going to see them. It's not, you know, they're smaller even in chunks. They're smaller than you can see easily. But if you had a microscope, you'd go in and you'd look, and that they were, these little particles were, various different kinds of particles were cemented together. And what causes that? As it turns out, and there's been some pretty good research, is the action of soil creatures, soil microbes, things like bacteria and other things, actually breaking down organic matter. It's the process of breaking that organic matter and turning it into something else that holds us together. That's really interesting. So when somebody tells you that, oh, you just, you know, you could put organic matter on your soil and it's going to last forever, it doesn't, because it's the process of breaking that down that creates the kind of aggregation you want. And it's something that has to go on all the time. Has to happen a lot. So you have to keep adding organic matter to your soil. It's more important than adding nitrogen. It's probably even, in our climate, certainly more important than irrigation. Adding that organic matter all the time is really important. And then the wetting and drying is the thing that actually forms, as the soil wets and dries over time, these granola-like particles. You know, like, imagine you got all these little pieces of oatmeal and nuts and all this kind of stuff stuck together in these things with a little bit of molasses. Well, that molasses, that whatever it is that holds it all together in the soil, is created by the action of these little microbes working. And they hold stuff together. There's also some chemical bonds that occur naturally in soil that happen. And so you want to preserve that. That's how you make good soil, is to preserve that granola-like texture rather than trying to make your soil look like fine wheat flour, like fine, you know, the flour that they used to make cake with. You remember that old, really, oh gosh, you folks don't cook. Anybody who used to cook would know that the really fine flours that they used to make them white cakes with, you know, the, you know how cakes used to look on the inside, or guess some of them still do. Really fine powder. I mean, really fine. Just, you could just, you know, you throw in the air, it just would drift. It was so fine. That's not what you want. You don't want that, because that's going to compact very easily. It really compacts very easily. And that kind of fine powder is no better for your plants than it is for your health when you eat it in a cake. So here's the thing. You want those granola chunks. You want those fine powder, the little individual soil particles to clump together like granola. And the only way to do that, and I just read a great study that really looked at the whole mechanism, is to have soil creatures, that's the important ingredient, acting on organic matter, leaves, whatever. So if we talk about this too much, we're not talking about it too much, because you really, it is the central thing you need to understand about gardening, is you got to have this good soil, and that soil has to be granola-like. If you go to the getting store, you know, them places, and you spend a fortune on getting some kind of contraption that you have off the ground because they say you got to have some kind of raised bed, and you get, and I don't know how much you're going to spend on filling that thing up with soil. Oh my goodness. And it's not even so, it's some kind of special weird mixture. It's not even special. It's a weird mixture that they've come up with for dumping into these things at the getting store so that you can get you to spend money. And you dump that in there, you know what's going to happen? It's going to compact. And because you keep thinking, oh, this is like some kind of permanent solution, it's not. And so after 1 year, you basically have to dig that soil out, or 2 years, and dig it out and start over again. And the way to avoid that kind of craziness is to think about adding organic matter. Adding organic matter in whatever form you can find it. And there are so many, listen, you live in one of the wettest climates in North America. Europe is super dry compared to anything you got. New England, Washington, D.C., they're all super dry. Seattle is super dry compared to your area, and that means you've got moisture and you've got green stuff that is always breaking down. You always have organic matter to add to your soil if you will just do it. And if you will understand how important that organic matter is to creating the kinds of granola-like soil particles out of the fine flour that your disastrous soil has become. The fine flour, that fine F-L-O-U-R, like soil, is not what you want. It's not what you want. That's why you don't need to use that tiller, because it's going to break it down. It's going to turn it into that fine flour pretty quickly, because it breaks down the bonds. I'm sorry. I had to get that out. And because it's pretty important. We're going to come back and answer some questions here, so hold on.
I'm going to pick no peace, because everything is going to fall. You got to get down on your bended knees. I ain't going to dig no more taters. I decline, I ain't going to pick no peace, because everything is going to.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. I'm just reading this question, which is got me thinking. Well, let's not start there. Let's start at the beginning with the questions that came first. Some of our listeners have been thinking a lot about kumquats lately. Good thing to think about. We've talked a good bit about them. They're great for South Alabama. Not so good for North Alabama unless you got them in a pot. And I don't know what the line is. Maybe somewhere between Atmore and Evergreen, where I would feel like kumquats are pretty good. Anybody's got any experience growing kumquats? Dad had a place for a long time around in the Black Belt. Love that place. Beautiful place. And he had, but we never tried kumquats there. And I guess I was just chicken. I experiment all the time, but I was too chicken to plant kumquats. I don't know how they'll do there. Maybe things are warm enough now that the kumquats will do okay. I think it might be a little cold, but South Alabama, they're going to do very well. They're very hardy. One of the hardiest citrus you can buy. And they're great for, you don't have to worry in Mobile, you don't really ever have to worry about frost or freeze doing severe damage to kumquats. They're really tough that way. And what does a kumquat do? Well, it's beautiful. It flowers. It has a great shape. It's easy to keep in bounds. It's got beautiful tasting fruit, wonderful fruit that can be used for a lot of different things. It's not like eating an orange, because you eat the peel, you eat the whole thing. Isn't that something? And in fact, the peel is often the sweetest part of a kumquat. In some kumquats, it is the sweetest part. The pulp's actually a little tart. The peel is actually sweet. Weird. Isn't that weird? So what is the best? Well, you're going to have two varieties, and that's that you're going to be able to get easily. Nagami and Miwa. Miwa is round, and it's said to be sweeter. Nagami is elongated and is said to be tartar, though, I actually like the taste of Nagami better. I think Miwa has a little bit of a stringent or something quality to it, but they're both fine. They're both good. I prefer Nagami. I think it is more versatile. I think you can use it in more things. It holds up better. Nagami is the elongated one. N-A-G-A-M-I. Did I spell that right? I think I did. There's another one called Fukushu. And occasionally you'll see it. And you may see it. The botanical guards will often have it. The botanical gardens often has it. And it's a good... It's a good one. It's just not as hearty. It actually has a great flavor. It's a cross between kumquats and mandarins, I believe. It has a lot. It's a bigger, slightly bigger thing, and fukushu. It's really great, but it's not as hearty. Be careful with it. It just needs a lot more work, and I'm not even sure that it's as hearty as, say, some mandarins. I've seen losses of fukushu, but those are the three you're going to get. I'll throw in another one, because we tend to forget about it. Kalamondin. Kalamansi. Kalamondin are really great little fruits that will superficially, in many ways, resemble kumquats. They're pretty hardy. They're very hardy. They're bigger, and they're more tree-like, but they're beautiful, and it makes a beautiful small tree for the Gulf Coast, and a great plant. I don't know how Kalamondin's going to stand up to some of the diseases we have moving through and you know, that are going to affect all citrus. I don't know how kumquats are going to react to those diseases. I'm moderately hopeful that both will stand up to them. But Kalamondin is a great little tree that resembles it. So does that help? Does that help at all? I have a Vitex tree, someone writes me, that I have not... that has not been trimmed in years. And so the question is, let me go back, when is the best time to have it done? Well, so the first question you always have to ask when you're pruning a tree, pruning anything, is, why am I pruning this? Because pruning is... done, it's not like the plant needs the pruning. It's you're the one that needs to prune because you have some goal in mind that the plant doesn't have in mind. Yeah, that's probably a good way of saying it. You have some goal in mind that the plant doesn't have in mind. So what is your goal in pruning? Do you want to make it? I don't know. I don't think you're going to make it a lot shorter. I mean, it just is the size it is. You may make it less dense and less twiggy, and that might be okay. You might make the base of it a little more open. So all those things are really, really important to ask. Maybe you're getting some dieback. I don't know if you are. Excuse the dogs if they happen to find some, hear some coyotes calling. But if you... you can hear them in the background a little bit. Just ignore that. But here's the thing. Why are you pruning the Vitex? Vitex is not an easy plant to prune, I will tell you. I don't really know what to tell you. Some people cut them all the way back. You're liable to lose some blooms. Or you may actually get better bloom from having more new growth. And some people on the Gulf Coast... can do that and will do that. Your bloom may be delayed. You might get a shorter bloom period, but you definitely do not want to do that now. You definitely don't want to do that now. You definitely would want to do that either, I would say probably, my prejudice would be to do it in March. First of March. Late February would be okay. Secondarily, you could do it after the first round of blooms. I think that's a little risky to do it that way. You might, again, you might lose some bloom if you do it, if you prune it back heavily, cutting it all the way to the ground in early in the year. But that can help. That can help you if you want a lot of new growth. You can cut it back to stubs, about knee to waist high, and that also is a little tricky, and you really want to have the right stubs, but let's make sure we actually want to prune that Vitex, and let's make sure we know why we want to prune it, and then I can help more. Tell me what you want. Why do you want to prune? Is there something about it that's not appealing to you? Is that what I'm hearing, or not? You don't feel obliged to prune. All right. What else we got here? New centipede sod came full of these 7-inch tall. Let's see. I see. Want to bloom more. Too tall, hanging over roof line. Yeah, so I, you know, it's always going to be a problem with the roof line because it's always going to want to be the same size, and it will achieve that same height pretty quickly, pretty rapidly. And, you know, it may actually be more of a problem if you cut it back, if it's too close to the house. So how close to the house is it? Tell me how close to the house it is. If you want more, you know, I'm not sure. I have heard people say that you can get better bloom out of your Vitex, your Chase tree, if you deadhead it, and it's probably not going to be more blooms. It's just probably going to be denser blooms. I don't know that it's going to solve the problem of the plant being too close to the house. It might make that a little bit worse. But if I were going to do it, I would do that in February, March. That's the simple story. And we could go on from there. Send me a note about how far this plant is from your house, and that will help me to understand what it is you can actually accomplish here. So let me know about how far is the base from the house. All right, let's see what else we got. B-Dark sent me several messages. Am I going to be able to keep up with all of them? I don't know. She says leaves are the best for organic matter. So we talked a lot. We talked a lot about soil this morning. And, you know, oak leaves, and I think oak leaves are great, and I have used them. They really are great. They have so many advantages. They're great at suppressing weeds, which is one of the really useful things about them. Much better, I think, than pine straw, probably better than grass. If I had to get rid of Bermuda grass, gosh, I have to teach myself how to pronounce that word, Bermuda grass. If I had to get rid of it in my beds, I would use the oak leaves. They're the best. And they do have a lot of calcium. They do have some other things that are really good for gardens. They tend to not break down too fast, but just kind of fast enough. It's all pretty good. And our oak leaves tend to be the right size for the most part because we got a ton of water oaks. We got a ton of laurel oaks. We got a ton of live oaks with smaller leaves that don't compact. So you don't have to worry about the leaves compacting. They actually end up with lots of air space in between those leaves, unlike big flat leaves from things like red oaks and some white oaks. Yeah, they're great. They're wonderful. But it's not the only thing. It's not the only thing, and there's a lot of different things out there. It's always good to have some leaves, some oak leaves mixed in, I agree, but there's lots of other leaves that can be very useful. So don't feel like you want to concentrate on just one thing. In fact, it's probably better to have a mixture of things as you're adding stuff to your soil. But B-Dark, I am agreeing with you that oak leaves are mighty fine. Mighty fine. And we got a lot of them. And that's even finer. Can I buy citrus trees from Botanical Gardens? John Oliver be with us soon, I hope, and can tell us about the plant sale this fall. I suspect there will be one. I don't control that because I don't know, and I'm sure people are making lots of decisions now about how to do that and whether to do it. But we'll be back. Usually you get the citrus in spring, not in fall. We'll talk later.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. It's a Mississippi and a Northwest Florida and a Georgia Sunday morning. Hey, we've got a lot of questions, a lot of interesting questions that I would love to talk with you all about. And I'll get you the name of that study. Somebody wanted it. I'll have to remember the names of the people who did it, but I'll do that in the next hour. So a question about crepe myrtle seeds. What do I do with them? I don't know. They are weedy, and they're probably, I actually wouldn't recommend planting crepe myrtle seeds for a whole bunch of reasons. Could you get crepe myrtles? Yes. Will those crepe myrtles be dependable? No. Will they bloom in your lifetime? Maybe, but it's not always certain. So let's see. I believe we're beautiful this year. They were Asian lady beetles everywhere. A lot of people are concerned. You can't control them, obviously. Any suggestions? My crepe myrtle trees are formed natural. What do you think is the course of treatment for the Asian lady beetle? You know, Asian lady beetle is an annoyance because it gets in houses. It's outcompeted some of our native ladybugs. And it probably, I don't know. I really don't know what the net negative effect is. But I'll tell you, on your crepe myrtle, which is just yet another invasive species that attracts other invasive species like the aphids that are basically turning our crepe myrtles into black sticks now. Yeah, you better have those Asian lady beetles. They may be the only things that actually prevent those aphids from actually turning your tree. So if your tree is not black right now, within you, aphid, the crepe myrtle aphid that's become such a problem. And it may be because you got tons of ladybugs. So enjoy them. They're probably helping you with that. So, yeah, I wouldn't do anything, Don, about that. I'd just keep them. I'd just let them go. And there's no way to control those guys. There really isn't. It's just, you can't do it. It's just not going to happen. There you go. I make clear, I think buying the citrus trees, Be Dark, and anybody else, I think that it's best to wait. It's best to wait until spring for most of those. And I've encouraged the botanical gardens back years ago to put most of those citrus plants for sale in the spring rather than the fall, because some of them are vulnerable. Kumquats would not be as vulnerable. I don't know. They may carry them. I don't know. Just don't know. We'll have to get John Olive on here to tell us about it. John is really helping, I think, a lot with some of the plant buying. So there you go. Tim in Cypress Shores has a couple of big questions. He did testify to the calamondin. He had it for 15 years in Cypress Shores. It was a good 25 feet tall, like a small ornamental tree, but the freeze 2 or 3 years ago took it out along with a mature satsuma. It was very hardy, and I never saw any problems with pests or diseases. The fruit went well with a Corona beer. Yes. It's a really delicious little thing. It's tart, but it's like a... it's like a sweet lemon. It's just a really, but it's lemony. It's tart, but it's really good and really useful for a lot of things. Just calamansi juice is one of the most delightful things. It's so much better than lemonade. And those from the Philippines who drink calamansi juice all the time can tell you it's a great little drink and very refreshing. When we get these extreme cold spells where we get warm weather and then a cold spell, it can damage a lot of citrus. And so some calamansi trees got hit, but that's probably not going to be an every year event. We will happen every now and then. And there you go. But calamondin's a great little tree. And even with that, it may well last longer than things like redbuds. I can just about guarantee you that your Calamansi tree, even with occasional rapid onsets of freezes and frost, will on average last longer than something like a redbud, certainly longer than a dogwood, and many other things that we plant for flowering plants. And so then he has this question, Tim. Oh, Tim. I have a pasture that I till once a year to plant a field of zinnias. Wow. That in itself is an interesting decision. And it raises all sorts of questions. It is choked so full of weeds that it seems tilling is the only way to get rid of all those massive roots in the topsoil. I try to till as shallow as possible. What's another solution to our problem of getting rid of the weeds that are so thick after laying fallow all year? Yeah, how are you going to handle this? I don't know. I mean, here's how a farmer would handle it. So you're trying to do something on the scale of a farmer, not the scale of a gardener, I guess, if you're trying to put your whole pasture in. And so farmers were faced with the problem that by continuously plowing and tilling, they were destroying their soil. And crop production was getting worse and worse. And so they started with something that we call no-till. They quit tilling. That's what no-till means. And so how did they deal with the weeds? Well, they didn't deal well with the weeds, even under the tilling practice, because they had to go into the field repeatedly to till those weeds out in order to get their crop. So they were continually having to cultivate, or they would go in like our great grandparents did with a hoe and hoe it out. Hoe the cotton. You remember all that? Oh, Lord. Don't ask an old timer. They're mostly gone now, but don't ask them about hoeing cotton because they'll tell you. I don't even know about hoeing cotton, and I'm so old. It's ridiculous. But what I can tell you is that farmers realized that was a huge problem and not a good way to handle weeds or to have soil, and so they started using herbicides. And they used herbicides to kill the weeds. And that's how a farmer would do it. That's the alternative. So, you know, you're not being good to your soil by continually doing that. But, you know, it's a peculiar kind of thing, putting those zinnias out. And I don't know what to tell you. It's when you start trying to cultivate like that at a very large scale, nothing natural happens. It then requires huge inputs from you. And it's hard for a normal person to manage something that large. And there's always going to be some really severe trade-offs. It's why I would say compact gardens are best, because you don't have as many trade-offs. You can actually manage things. We're going to be back.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Some questions get harder, some questions get easier. Bruce. Oh, man, Bruce is fussing at me this morning, folks. Bruce is not happy. B-Dark, Bruce is not at all happy with his Korean squash. which, you know, I'm looking this thing up, and we still don't know how to pronounce it. King, which I don't know whether that's a Korean king, which might be more like Jing, or whether it's an American king, which is Ka, or Ga, which might be, I don't know, I, King Ka E, King Ka A, King Ka I, I'm not sure which. Somewhere in there is that's the Korean word, but it's a great little squash. One that starts with King. We're going to call it the King Squash. And B-Dark's loving it. I'm loving it. Man, I have picked so many, and I've missed so many. That's the big problem. It really drives me crazy. I have missed, you know, they kind of hide under those leaves, and if you miss them, they get a little too big. But we've been eating, I mean, every week we're producing as many of those squash as we can eat from a couple or three plants. But Bruce is mad at me because I didn't stress enough. These plants can get big. They are. They're like pumpkins. It's like growing a pumpkin. It's like growing a watermelon. It's like growing a lot of melons, as a matter of fact. And that's how squash used to be. You can put them on a trellis, which I have done, and I think that's a good idea. And it makes it much easier to find. It means it'd be a moderately large, small, strong trellis. But it's very easy to do, and it's kind of fun to do, and you can easily find the fruits. Sort of like you were doing for cucumbers. You know, I put my cucumbers on a trellis. I put these on a trellis. And they can even outgrow the trellis, but it certainly helps to have a trellis with these guys. Bruce, I can't tell you why you only have one, but I suspect you will start getting a lot more as fall progresses. I don't know why you only have one. Don't know. But they can get big, and with lots of rain and lots of fertilizer, they'll get really, really big. There you go. A testament from Jim in Georgetown. As far as crepe myrtle seeds go, the only reason I don't have crepe myrtle woods is the lawnmower. And they grow 6 to 8 feet in a year. And they do. And they're really becoming, crepe myrtles are becoming a real problem in the forest. And they're not our worst problem. But if you've got, you can have a ton of crepe myrtles coming up around your house. You know, the crepe myrtle seeds are an issue. One thing, it probably helps a little bit to prune those off, but it's a pain to do it. But definitely don't try to spread them around, because boy. B-Dark is talking about bootleg seed. Well, no, it's probably not. I mean, they're different growing conditions, and they're different things, and Bruce is really good, and he's a really smart guy, and B-Dark, and we're gonna wait it out here. We're going to see if Bruce doesn't get more. And Bruce, if you don't get more, call me back and fuss at me so we can figure out why you didn't get more. But we're getting lots, and B-Dark sending me pictures of hers. I picked a bunch yesterday. Man, they just keep going. They just keep going. All right, let's see what else we got. So Tim, I get to come back to Tim. Tim, we've been talking about, we talked about tilling and plowing, and we talked about organic matter, and we talked about how it helps soil, and we talked about how that organic matter, listen, somebody wanted the study. So I'm going to give you the study. Effective organic amendment on soil aggregation and microbial community composition during drying, rewetting, alternation. It's by a, here's another one. This is not the one. Let's look at this one. A microbial decomposition of organic matter and wetting drying promotes aggregation in artificial soil, but porosity increases only in wet, dry condition. Interesting study, July 2024 in Geoderma, Geoderma. Look for Geoderma and microbial decomposition of organic matter on a search, and you'll probably find it. The first author is a guy named Rabbi. The senior author is Ian M. Young. He's the last one, but you can look for Robbie, Microbial Decomposition of Organic Matter, in the journal Geoderma, The Skin of the Earth. Great title for a academic journal. So, Tim, we're back to this question of what is Tim going to do about his zinnias? So we are plowing and tilling. Why? To break up the soil, to make it easier to plant into. But there was also, it evolved into a way to deal with seeds. Once you had this tiller, you were going to go through and you were going to cultivate to get rid of the weeds. Well, one of the problems with cultivating like that, and that farmers found out over and over, is that when you turn the soil, you actually increase the number of weeds because you bring the weed seeds to the surface that would otherwise be buried and wouldn't germinate. Most weed seeds need to see the sun to germinate, and they need to be near the surface to germinate. And so when you till, you bring those to the surface, and so you're going to have a continuing problem with weeds. So that's one problem with another problem with tilling that people don't think about. It's huge. It's a big problem. So it wasn't a perfect way of dealing, and so that means you had to go back in and you had to till again, and that means you destroyed your soil even faster because you were tilling multiple times a year. You're destroying that granola-like texture and turning it into this fine, fine cake flour, which compacted easily, and the plants didn't grow well in, and it didn't hold moisture, and it didn't hold nutrients, and it was just a mess. So how do you get off that treadmill is the question. The way farmers got off of it was to go to no-till and herbicides. Herbicides created their own problems, and still do. Even if you don't care about the impact of herbicides on anything else, if you don't care if it gives your grandchildren eight eyes, you don't care about any of that. You don't care if anything, and I don't think herbicides are the worst chemical out there. I don't think they're the best. I think they have problems. I think we can use herbicides intelligently, but if you're using them all the time at the scale we're using them, you're going to run into big problems because if nothing else, the plants are going to become resistant to the herbicides, and that's what's happened. And that's a big deal for a lot of farmers because they don't know how to control weeds anymore. And there are a lot of fields where I can see visibly that weed control is getting less effective in no-till. It's just really obvious. And it's a big issue. And then you have to come up with more dangerous chemicals chemicals more dangerous than Roundup that spread, and it just goes on and on. So that's a treadmill. That's a problem too. And so it's this classic problem that is goes back to Genesis, I reckon, if you will. It's the classic human problem. How do you cultivate and minimize the impact of your cultivation so that you're not on one treadmill or another that is non-productive? And societies have dealt with it in many ways over a long period of time in some really ingenious ways. At a scale of 20 to 30 feet, 20 by 30 feet, that's a big scale, but it's not impossible. Where Tim wants to grow his zinnias, and what is he going to do? You know, you are destroying Cypress Shores. Please believe me, I know those soils. I have very fond memories of Cypress Shores between the age of 5 and 10 years old when I lived there. Let's come back and talk about what Tim's going to do in order to plant 20 by 30 feet of zinnias. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
So So a lot of quick things. Listen, we got a lot to tell, a lot to talk about. John Olive called in and texted in, and it was good that he did, and said, yes, there's going to be a plant sale. It's going to be, what did you say, John, October 9, I think it is. Let me go back. Hold on. MGEB fall plant sale, October 9, 10, and 11. Can't give a lot of details yet. Too early to know if what we order will match what we get. I know that story, John. Please believe me. You know, we, back in the days when I was helping do the ordering, you know, I would say, oh, we need to get this and this and this and this and this. But you often didn't know until right before the sale what you were actually going to get, even if you ordered it. That's just the way it is. He did say we will have some citrus but had trouble getting kumquats, so probably won't have any for fall. Most citrus is in spring, John says, but some citrus for fall. And I will back that up with Jim in Georgetown saying, if you buy in fall, I endorse this 100%, you're going to need to protect that citrus over the winter unless it's a kumquat. You really are going to need to be very careful because you could lose that plant over the winter. And that means you might need to put it in the garage. It's one way to do it. Or lay it down, as I have said to do, and on the south side of your house during most cold spells, and cold spells meaning for young citrus like that in a pot, anything below about 28 degrees, just lay it down and cover it. It's more trouble to manage that citrus in fall. It's not impossible, but it's a lot of trouble. So there it is. But yes, there will be a plant sale. And no, there probably won't be kumquats. But we're going to get kumquats, I think, probably for spring. There's a slight thaw in our relationship with Bruce. Bruce. Oh, man. So Bruce is upset. He's got 40 feet of vine and one fruit. Well, as it turns out, he's got 40 feet of vine and three fruit from this Korean squash that we're going to call King Ka A. King Ka I. King Ka A. Something like that. It's Korean, but let's just call it the King Squash. Here's how to spell it. K-I-N-G. You got that. Space K-A. Space A-E. K-I-N-G space K-A space A-E. If there's a translation for that one day, maybe we'll find a way to do it. Kitazawa Seeds has it. It's been really great for me. We've gotten so much squash out of that plant. B-Dark has gotten so much squash out of that plant. But they do grow big. You know, usually at 40 feet, you're going to have gotten a few more than three squash. At this point, I'm not sure what's going on in Bruce's situation. But it, you know, my yard right now, I'm probably going to be in trouble because I grew a bunch of winter squash. And I've got some great winter squash that I'm really excited about that lasts us through the winter. And I got a ton of it. It's producing a ton of it finally. And it'll be producing it this fall. And it's great. And these big winter squash of all kinds, along with King Kai and a lot of other things, various other experimental squash, they're all vining squashes. And boy, it's just like everywhere in my yard I got these squash. They're actually, I have to pull them out of my sweet potato bed, which itself is kind of a rambler. So I have to pull them out of the sweet potato bed. I have to pull them off of, and they grow. I mean, and it's one of the issues. So how do you manage something like that? It's a good question. I'm going to get better at it. I'm going to think about it. How do you manage it? Because basically it's going to sprawl across the lawn. Is that a problem? I think it's cool. I think it's so cool looking to see all those beautiful squash leaves spreading across the lawn, pumpkin leaves, whatever you want to call them, winter pumpkins, winter squash. It's cool. Watermelon's the same way. How do you manage that when you got that big growth that grows everywhere? Melons. trellising can help with smaller fruited things. With winter squash, you can't really trellis it because the fruits are too big. But with Kinkha, with that Korean ball squash, the Korean elongated squash, the Korean king squash, you can trellis it, and that helps a lot. But yes, it is a thing, and we need to be better at it because we just do. Yeah, Keith is egging Bruce on. Why am I the victim here? Why am I the victim? There it is. Because I didn't give Bruce enough heads up that this is a really big squash. A really big squash. What else have we got that we need to get back to? Tim! Goodness gracious. I don't want to forget about Tim. Tim, you know, if Tim's got a big 20 by 30 area bed that he plants in zinnias, and then he has weeds every year. And I don't think that's the best way to manage it, particularly at Cypress Shores, where those soils can go bad pretty quickly, particularly with frequent tilling. And you can have some moisture issues. Here's what I would do. I would definitely fill that bed up with as many leaves as I could find, just to bolster your organic matter. The leaves themselves will suppress, and as soon as your zinnias go down, throw those leaves in there. The leaves will suppress a lot of weeds and make it easier to deal with. If it doesn't suppress enough of the weeds, then I think you can put a cover over that. That's a lot of tarp, but you could put a tarp over it. That would keep things dark. Pieces of tin, whatever else you can find that's big enough. It's better if it's permeable to water, but not to light. And there's several products I've used. I'm experimenting with a fabric that's basically like felt, but it's felty like and very flexible, and you definitely don't want to do it with roofing felt because it's got all that asphalt in it. Not good for your garden. But lay something over that if you need to suppress weeds more until you're ready to plant. If it's permeable to water, it's even better, or even just a little bit permeable to water, it's better. And that's how I would handle it. I would at least do it in part of the yard, in part of that area each year. So if you can't figure out how to do it over the whole thing, take a third each year and do it there, and then rotate that so that you don't have to till that whole thing. And then eventually I think you're probably going to get a situation where you're not going to have that many weed seeds. You're probably actually encouraging those weed seeds by the way you're managing it now. So it's the off season where you're going to have to do this. And it's not that hard. And look for some leaves. I bet you can find bag leaves in Cypress Shores still. And even if it's pine straw, that's fine. Just throw the pine straw on there. Throw a little calcium on top of it if you need to with some lime or some other things every now and then. You can throw the fertilizer on there after, you know, as you get closer to planting time. But I think that's the way to do it. You know, it's the classic Adam and Eve problem. We got to deal with weeds. We decided we were going to take matters into our own hands and cultivate the planet. Well, guess what? You got to think about a lot of things at once. You got to think about the soil. You got to think about the weeds. You got to think about how to deal with that. But a lot of times that organic matter is the basic ingredient. You can use the organic matter to suppress the weeds. And I've used it. So, Tim, while I've got just a little time, I'll say that I've used organic matter. There's a killer mulch that I've used that just basically kills weeds really well. We'll talk about that when I come back.
Oh, I'll
you get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, all right, let's get back to some questions. We got a lot of them, and they're all fun, and they're all good, and it's all good to know. My new centipede lawn came full of these 7-inch tall seed heads. Is it a weed, and how can I get rid of it? We finally got the picture that's pretty clear now, and I can tell you that is that terrible weed that's in your centipede lawn that's flowering now is called centipede. That's a centipede seed head. I hope that centipede continues to act like a weed and grow aggressively in your yard. I find that it doesn't grow like a weed most of the time, and we have some big problems with it. It's why I don't recommend it that often. But yes, that is a centipede seed head. It's just doing its thing. It doesn't seed in as often. It doesn't produce seed heads as often as some grasses, but yours got a little long in the tooth and produced a seed head, and that's okay. It's fine. It'll be fine. And maybe some of those seeds will actually, if they're not clonal, if they're not apomictic and produce basically clonal, you might get some seed that might be better adapted to our climate. It's a remote possibility, but you can always hope for the best with centipede, and you probably won't get it, but there it is. So then we're getting all these great questions about timing now and of planting and getting the organic matter prepared, and that is just a great question. And that is a question that I'm going to be asking for B. Dark, who says, look, the squash took over my summer garden. Where do I plant my winter garden? Do I have to plant my winter garden in a separate place from the summer garden? And it's a question of, well, do you have enough sun left in your summer garden to get enough sun? You know, in some ways, a little bit of shade this time of year is not such a bad thing if you know those plants are going to die back as these winter plants are maturing. So is it a bad thing to plant? Would it have been a bad thing to plant your winter garden next to your tomatoes or almost under your tomatoes? And probably not, because the tomatoes are going to not do so well. You could probably sneak them in around. You could probably sneak some winter plants in around things like peppers and other things. Certainly around your peas. Like, I got a lot of peas. I planted a lot of peas. They're all pooping out now. You know, field peas, whippoorwill peas, pekin purple hull peas, that kind of pea. They're pooping out now. So I can plant my winter stuff there, and the soil will be nice and good. It's not too weedy because those plants have shaded everything out. I think you can compromise with where the squash is. You can just move the squash over just a little bit. If you ever move those, just move the vine over a little bit, and it'll reroot next to it, and then you'll have a little place where you can. So, no, I do think you can integrate your winter vegetables into your summer beds. And it doesn't have to be just a discrete area. I mean, you can scatter your winter plants, your broccoli and other things throughout that. The one thing about some winter plants in some climates is you may need to cover them, so it may be a good idea to compact them. But things that you're going to plant on the harvest on the front end, like cabbages and other things, it might be okay. And parsley you can plant anywhere on the Gulf Coast because it's not going to get killed by frost. So you can scatter that in just about anywhere. You can scatter it in around your basil because you know your basil is going to go down and you're going to have a hole there. So there it is. Now, Amy says, do I start my, but here's the ideal situation. Do I start my summer beds in fall? Yes, that's the way to do it. Do I start my winter beds in spring? Yes, or summer. That's the way to do it. And so, you know, when you're planting your summer crops, it's good to get those started in fall, but you can actually do it late into winter on the Gulf Coast because the days are staying warm. We still have plenty of warm days. Organic matter is still breaking down, And you know what? I can throw leaves, Amy, on the ground in November, early November, late October, early November, and even into December. And they're going to be broken down by the time I'm ready to plant my tomatoes on the Gulf Coast. May take a little longer the farther north you go. And they don't have to be perfectly broken down. It just needs some of it broken down, and you can plant in the part that's moderately broken down. And those roots will take off. So, yes, you do want to think ahead. And thinking ahead is, it's, life is hard when you're just reacting to what's happening right now. And it's hard to fix things. But if you think ahead, it still ain't perfect, but it helps a little bit. Certainly helps to think ahead. And you need to begin planning for your next summer's garden now. And you have plenty of time to work on that garden and still have it break down if you're on the Gulf Coast. Amy, am I helping at all? But yes, yes. And what else did you ask about? Putting hay around plants now and letting it work from now on. Yeah, and that's going to work. Just, you know, using that hay as a mulch. If the hay has lots of weed seeds in it, that can be a problem. If the hay has, listen, guys, if the hay has chemicals in it, and a lot of hay does now, and it will be retained in that hay, and it can be damaging to your plants. I know you don't care about what happens to you. Psh, you don't care about that. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about those chemicals and what they do to you. That's that. But you got to worry about what happens to your plants, right? So there you go. I just be careful about that. Even weeds have a purpose, Don says. Yes, yes. And so I don't know what we were disagreeing about, but boy, Don, even weeds have a purpose is absolutely right. And I use weeds all the time. And one other good thing to think about, when you're thinking about mulch and you're thinking about organic matter, I keep stressing this to people I know who are generally suspicious of me, and they should be, I reckon. But I keep saying, look, these weeds, they're going to make the best mulch. They're going to make the best organic matter. They're going to make the best soil. And that's true. So people want to come in and plant clover and yakety-yakety-yakety-yakety-yak, something that they can buy that costs a lot of money, that costs a lot of money. And the weeds that they have out there may be the very best things they can do for their soil. I want to talk about this. I guess I'm going to talk about it. This is really dangerous to say out loud. But you know what? Good old ambrosia, Gigantea, otherwise known as giant ragweed, it's one of the best soil things you can possibly do. It controls the weeds while it's growing. You know, if you could get some giant ragweed to come in after your zinnias, Tim, it would control most of the weeds. It's really great. It actually is great for the soil, and it's just this incredible thing. And I, you know, putting the, it's a really wonderful thing. It stops germination of weed seeds. There's so many other weeds out there, things that we think of as weeds, that are so good. And you know what? As it turns out, the horses love giant ragweed. And I've heard people talk about that they would call it hogweed or horseweed because the hogs and the horses loved it. It's high in protein. It's really good. The horses will just go by. I can't even walk them by. Best mules, my wife's mules. I can't even walk them by this giant ragweed without them just jerking on the line and jerking their heads over to eat the tops out of the giant ragweed. They love the stuff. I mean, they'll eat it down to the point that I don't have any seeds, and I got to control that a little bit. Weed seeds can be very important. When you gather your weeds, put them in a pile and let that pile get up pretty high, and it'll be the best soil you've had. Are there seeds in there? Maybe. But those seeds are going to fall through, and they're going to be on the bottom. And as long as you don't turn that soil, those seeds are not going to germinate because they're not going to see the sunlight. It's really even better to do it before they set seeds. Then you don't have to worry about it at all. You're okay. Would I do that with Bermuda grass? Gosh, I can't do it. Bermuda grass. Would I have to do it with, would I do that with Bermuda grass? Probably not. I would make a separate pile of it and I would let it dry out real good because those roots can reactivate pretty easily in a pile and then reroot. But most weed seeds, when you pull them up, Kogon grass, same thing could happen with Kogon, unless you just cut the tops out. But if you pull the roots up, you got a problem. If you're just pulling the tops, you don't have a problem with that, with those roots. But, you know, experiment with those weeds. They're really quite good. They're really quite good. Let's see. What did I do anything right, B-Dark? It's hard to tell sometimes. But, you know, tuck your... you can go ahead and try to tuck some of that winter stuff in and around your your squash and your other summer stuff, and then you can have a separate bed. That's not a Stouter boat in the background, is it, B-Dark? Is that a boat? Can't tell. She sent me a picture. Looks like maybe a Stouter. Got Stouter boat green on it. I miss my Stouter boat. So there it is. Did we help at all with soil? I hope we did. It's the organic matter that's so important. I'll come back to that. We explained in the first part of the show how that happens, because what that organic matter does, it has many benefits. It actually provides nitrogen and phosphorus and potassium. It does all those things. It actually serves as a fertilizer. But it also rebuilds the soil, reconstructs the soil so that it's not like fine cake flour, which is not what your plants are going to want. They're going to struggle. They're going to have a really hard time, and that, because that soil is going to compact. It's not going to hold on to water. It's not going to let water drain through. It's just terrible. You don't want cake flour. You want these aggregate particles that resemble granola. I don't know why I'm stuck on granola, but there it is. That's a good way of thinking about it. It's not like cake flour. It's like granola. And you're not going to be able to actually see the granola particles, but you can imagine that they're kind of like granola particles with all these little pieces stuck together so that the spaces around those pieces of granola are bigger and water can flow through, but that each little piece of granola can actually absorb water as well and release it slowly to the plant roots without flooding everything. They also hold on to oxygen. It's such an incredible thing. You know, it was the consolation to Adam and Eve to understand how organic matter can make your life easier. I declare I ain't gonna pick no peas,
because everything is on the phone. FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. Goodness gracious, I got a lot of questions to answer here in the last segment. How am I going to get to everything? There's no such thing as an old flounder boat. B-Dark. It's a good flounder boat, looks like it. Flounder boat's a nice thing to have. It's getting in the way of her winter garden. She'll find a good use for it. Don wants me to be sure to mention his crepe myrtle trellis, and I am happy to do it because I made a crepe myrtle trellis. Crepe myrtle is interesting. Those branches can last a good while. Don't last forever, but they do last a good while, more than, say, something like a hickory or even most oak branches that you might use to make a trellis with. And so they last a good while in contact with the soil. Moderate amount of time. So they're great for making trellises. And Don did not send me a picture of his crepe myrtle trellis, but I've had one, and they're really great for that. And probably they make... you will find in the future, as these diseases become more prominent, that crepe myrtles are going to make better trellises than ornamental plants. And it's a good use for it. Maybe a great use for crepe myrtles is to make good ornamental plants out of those big, those nice curvy, nice sinewy branches. Sinewy is a good word for that. Even weeds have burrs. We agreed on that. Let's see. Did we get all this? The Vitex, we had a question about the chase tree, how to prune it. And that Vitex is, so I asked about how far and why are you pruning it? And pruning it, I think, because it's getting too big for its britches. It's getting too big for the spot. It's actually not the Vitex's fault. It's the planting. It's the fault of the planting. It's only 4 feet from the house. Vitex are going to be 8 feet wide, no matter what. And so it's always going to infringe on the house a little bit. And they're probably even bigger. They're really, they're going to get spread out to about 10 feet. And it's going to be hard to keep it. It's a tree. It will always be a tree. It will never be fully a bush. So I don't know how you're going to prune it back. You'd have to prune it back repeatedly to keep it off the house. But you can try. I would certainly begin by pruning off the branches, the bigger branches on the backside. Could you prune every year like you did a fig? And this is possible. To think about pruning Vitex every year as if it were a fig, and you prune out the thickest. I prune out the thickest canes every year so that I get more new stuff coming up. How you would do that in a Vitex is a little more complicated, but it's probably doable, and I guess I could see how to do it if I were shaping it. It's going to be a little technical. It's probably not going to solve all your problems, but it's possible you could do it that way. Prune out the heaviest, thickest stems each year. That will allow more light. Prune out the limbs that are growing in. But in general, if I were going to prune it heavily and I were only going to do it once a year, I would wait until spring, February, March. I might do it after it blooms the first round, but still, I think all in all, it's probably better to do it right there after that first flush in spring is probably the best time to do it. Okay, what else did I get? She can put her winter garden. B-Dar's going to put her winter garden in the flounder boat. And, yeah, so there you go. But that's not the best use of a flounder boat, right? It's not the best use. And I think that would cause some other problems, of course. I don't think you're too serious about it. But let's see what else. I know there was another question that I didn't quite get to. Well, maybe I did. Maybe I got to everything. Tim, I hope that I helped thinking a little bit. I do think you'll need some organic matter in that zinnia bed. Use a killer mulch, which we didn't talk about enough. A killer mulch is when you put on so much mulch that it basically kills anything growing in the soil. And it breaks down, and then it becomes a great soil. But that initial heavy mulch is really great. That's why I say, if you can, on your zinnia beds, if you can just, you can't put a killer mulch over that whole zinnia bed. That's a lot of leaves. But take areas and put a killer mulch on there. You know, 4 feet's enough. 4 feet of leaves. Just dump your leaves. Just dump leaves in those areas. And at least do a third of your bed each year. If you have enough leaves to do the whole bed, that's great. Over time, you won't have to use the killer mulch because you'll have fewer weeds, except those that creep in from the edges, like Bermuda grass and like Kogon grass, which I'm sure is now a problem in Cypress Shores, as it is everywhere. But yes, I mean, one of the keys is managing good soil is about both making a good soil environment and managing the weeds, which is a big reason why people got stuck on the treadmill of tilling, which then destroyed the soil, which then created more weed seeds, which required more tilling. It's a weird thing. So how do we break that cycle? I think thinking about organic matter, which really is, Don, yeah, I think you'll agree, it's one of the great gifts to Adam and Eve was having organic matter, and I hope they figured that one out pretty soon, because it really does make a huge difference in how your garden grows. It makes more difference than anything else you can do to your garden. Anything else, it makes more difference than irrigation. It makes more difference than nitrogen applications, more difference than herbicide applications. It is the most important thing. It's the thing you can't really do without in the long run, because that organic matter reassembles the soil in some pretty cool ways that make the soil better for plant growth. And how did that miraculous thing happen? Over all these billions of years, you know, it was, well, let's call it half a billion years, excuse me, that this has been going on in soils, is the organic matter tending to the plants producing the organic matter that tends the plants. It's this incredible cycle. Isn't that incredible? How did that happen? How did that happen? But it happened. And so you've got to understand that that's the ancient cycle. It's the way plants evolved producing. In fact, plants evolved to produce their own, well, they produced their own soil. They produced their own soil by decomposing, getting integrated into the soil. Do you need to turn that in? I should have said this early on. No, I actually think you don't. And you should call me back next week and we'll talk more about why you probably don't need to turn things into the soil. We'll be back. Thanks for listening.